for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For this month's Reader's Review, we've chosen the 2009 Pulitzer Prize-winning work of fiction, Olive Kitteridge. It's a collection of 13 short stories set in small-town Maine. The judges said it packs a cumulative emotional wallop. The title character appears in all the stories, sometimes only briefly. She struggles with changes in the town and within herself as she moves from middle to old age. The judges described her as blunt, flawed, and fascinating. Joining me here in the studio is Kate Lara. She's author of 4 novels. Jackson Breyer, he's professor emeritus of English at the University of Maryland. And Leslie Maitland, she's memoirist and former New York Times reporter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Hi, Diane.
Kate Lara, is this a novel or is it a collection of short stories?
Well, it's one of those rare, rare books which can be read either way, but it's certainly a novel. But each story stands alone. I can't think of one of these stories that wouldn't do it. And the only other person I can think of offhand that did succeed is Malamud, who did this once in one of his books. And I can't remember. This morning I was thinking of that. I can't remember which one, but he achieved that goal. But you can read it either way. It's the accumulation of all these stories. It takes all of them to get the well-rounded picture of Olive.
Jackson Breyer.
I agree. There is an arc to the book. I wrote out a little chart for myself after reading it, and by far the majority of stories have Olive either as the central character or as a major character. There are only about 3 or 4 I think, that in which she makes what you would call a cameo appearance. But even in those cameo appearances, you learn something about her as seen from other people's point of view. So the focus is pretty much on Olive and, on, as Kate says, on the town and the people in the town.
You recently spoke to Elizabeth Strout.
Yes, I did.
Tell me what she thought about her own book.
Well, she kept talking about the arc of the book. I mean, very definitely the last story in the book, which she feels, and I feel too, makes the book ultimately a very hopeful book, where Olive finds a second man for her life in old age. That coming at the end sort of puts a sort of coda on the whole story, and I think Elizabeth regards it as a book that has an arc to it. But as she said, when she started to write it, she realized that Olive was too intense a character, too much of a character to be able to sustain her through an entire novel, and that she needed to put stories in the book that viewed Olive from the outside as well as the central character.
And Leslie Maitland, that first story, Pharmacy, puts her on the periphery as she is introduced to us. I'm told that that was not the first story that Elizabeth Strout wrote.
Actually, the first story she wrote was apparently the story in which her son gets married, and she is so angry and so worried about losing this son, who is the love of her life, really, that she takes some vicious action against the daughter-in-law.
But I don't think that's why she took that vicious action. I think she took that vicious action because the dress that she had worked so hard on, she made it herself out of this big flowered material, and she overheard the bride talking about this dress. And that's when she took the vicious action.
Well, I think she recognized that this young woman, a gastroenterologist from a very different background, was, as she put it, a know-it-all and very sure of herself. And she wanted to make sure by doing things like stealing a shoe or an undergarment or marking up her sweater in hiding in the closet, that the girl would have reason to scratch her head and say,
"My goodness." She took one boot or yeah, one shoe and one something yeah. else, Jackson.
Yeah, but I think that that story, I mean, we were talking before we came in here that these stories really ought to be read a second time, because when you read them through the first time, you're paying so much attention to what's happening in them that you don't really see the connections. And one of the things that happens in that story, as you say, this insult to Olive's dress really represents to Olive at that point this outsider coming to Maine and stealing her son away. Right. And this outsider who doesn't know the difference between nasturtiums and another flower that Olive has planted, and who cannot, I mean, this book is as much about this place and about what's happening to this place, Crosby, Maine, on the coast of Maine, and how it's gradually being invaded and being somewhat diluted by outside people. Mm-hmm. And when Dr. Sue, her daughter-in-law, insults her dress, it really hurts Olive to the core. And Leslie's right. I mean, Olive has plenty to resent her about to start with, but this is really
the
ultimate.
Kicker.
Yes, she says that, you know, she overhears the conversation with the young bride saying to a friend of hers, "They just dress differently up here." And, of course, Olive is looking down on all of them because they're wearing black. They're not wearing any color. And she thinks that's just
I want to go back to the story, pharmacy, because I found putting her husband, Henry, as the main character of that story. He seems like such a decent fellow.
Yes, I must say, I found the pharmacy was, in a way, maybe my favorite story. Mm. You're right. He is so decent. Olive puts him down, saying that he sees life as if it were a Sears catalog with everybody just standing around and smiling. He is, his daughter-in-law later describes him as a doll. I mean, he is a kind, good man. When he reaches out to a young widow and tries to help her, Olive's first reaction is very cruel. When the girl loses her husband, Olive says, "Well, she could have just gone off to join the Foreign Legion." She calls Henry "you widow comforter."
She is really cruel.
She is cruel in that first story.
Yeah.
Henry is shown to be, well, he says it's the happiest moment of his life. He's giving, he's feeling appreciated.
Exactly.
He's reaching out to this young couple starting out in life, and he's a warm-hearted, decent man.
I think she's also jealous of Henry because he can relate so
exactly.
well to human
and
beings.
I don't know if it's in this story or another story where she's just thinking. She says in her mind, but he's an innocent. It's how he's learned to get through life. And that's part of it. And what makes that story of the pharmacy so complicated, though, is that while he's in love or has this fascination with, infatuated with this young woman, the fact is you feel Olive's, he's drawn to her as a life force, and this is what you get of Olive in that story. It's that she represents eroticism to him, too. The young couple together represent it, but Olive herself he sees as a life force. And his growing up was a very hard, needy background.
Right.
It's the distrust that comes through all the generations here, I think, that forms a very fascinating sub-theme.
Well, what's interesting, Elizabeth says that these stories sort of fell into place and that the juxtaposition of them shouldn't really be regarded as totally significant. But it is very important that after the first story, in which you get a very sort of negative view of Olive, as Leslie and Kate say, she sort of beats at Henry. In the very next story, Incoming Tide, she basically saves this young man's life. Who
Talk
is about
how she does
well,
that.
What happens is there's this young man who has grown up in the town, has moved away. His mother committed suicide. Suicide, by the way, is a big motif throughout
Indeed.
This novel. And he comes back to kill himself. He comes back in a car with a rifle in the back seat, and he's parked in a parking lot by the marina. And suddenly Olive pokes her head in the car and sits down and starts to talk to him. And I think this is a story that gets greater resonance after you've read the whole book, because if you know, you don't know at the point when you read this story what Olive's full relationship with her own son is. But when you finish the book and you go back and look at that story and see how she talks to Kevin, and actually she refers to Christopher in that story and finds in Christopher something that she can relate to in a situation where she's had great difficulty relating to Christopher, as we later find out. And in a way, she saves his life. I mean, it's not quite clear exactly how she does, but this is one of those stories where Olive talking to somebody can show empathy to other people in a way that she cannot see about herself. In other words, she can provide a very comforting and very right kind of response to someone else's problem. And there are several stories in which that happens.
But she doesn't do it with her husband. And that's one area that I found myself really wondering about until we get near the end. The book we're talking about, Olive Kitteridge, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for 2009.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is an appreciation of public radio and its commitment to introducing music to all walks of life. From Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
And if you're just joining us, this is our Reader's Review, the book we've chosen for this month, Olive Kitteridge by Elizabeth Strout. It won the 2009 Pulitzer Prize. Here in the studio, Jackson Breyer, Leslie Maitland, Kate Lara. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. This gets to something you were saying earlier, Kate. It's an email from Catherine who says, to what extent do you think that Olive's behavior, particularly her ability to reach out to people in peril, is shaped by her family history of mental illness?
Oh, I think that's a wonderful question, and I think it's shaped completely almost by her family's mental illness. Her father, which we find out a lot more about in the second story, again, through somebody else's eyes, really, she's willing to talk about it, that he killed himself in, I think it was their kitchen, and she, I think, as I remember it, she found the body. But Kevin, whom at this point she's trying to talk out of suicide himself, she goes for the weak, you know, the weak, the people who
can't, needy.
The needy. And it's because she intuits that. She couldn't do it with her father. She says her father had told her 39 years ago when he killed himself that he was very despondent. He didn't see the reason to live, and she had handled it lightly. She herself had just gotten married, had a child. Ever after that, she, of course, clearly, the guilt is huge. And then she smothers Christopher, which...
Her son.
Her son, which comes out later in all that. But it's, she reaches out to these people. All, the more needy they are, the more she can reach out and help them.
But actually, when you look back, it seems that the only people she really does reach out to are younger people. She's a former math teacher, a middle school math teacher. And all of the people she reaches out to are young. Many of them are former students of hers. The older people, her peers in age, when she finds them in trouble, actually their troubles give her a kind of solace. She goes to visit people to hear that their situation is worse than hers.
And one of them threw her out.
One of them says, you came here for some schadenfreude, some joy in my grief. But so I don't think that Olive's generosity towards others is really as... that sweeping.
It's not consistent.
It's not consistent.
But she, there is some part of her, I think, that's trying.
Well, it's the maternal. So maybe her love for her son. She reaches out to these other young people, former teacher, and a mother who enjoyed being a mother, and as Kate said, smothered her son. But
she thought he was enjoying it, too. What a terrible situation.
One of the things I really liked about this book, and I think anybody who reads it would agree with this, is it's very non-judgmental about people. In other words, everything Leslie says is true, but there's always a but in the sentence about any of these characters. And, I instantly feel when I hear Leslie talk, I have to defend Olive. And I'm sure if somebody was easy on Olive, I'd also say, but wait a minute, look at what she does to so-and-so. And but I think Elizabeth Strout is very non-judgmental about these people. She simply tells you that life is complicated, that you should not come to hasty judgments about people. That's one of the reasons these stories are told from different points of view, because it depends who's looking at a situation as to whether you can view it in one way or in another way.
Do we know that Olive was a good and effective math teacher?
She seems to be. Most of her students are afraid of her, but several of them like her almost in spite of their fear. That is the way I take it, and that she probably really did teach them.
I think we have to talk about Patty Howe and whether, in fact, her fall off the cliff was suicidal or not. Apparently, book clubs have great discussions on this point.
I asked Elizabeth Strout just that question yesterday. And
she's not going to tell you,
no,
is
she? No, she did tell me.
She did.
About some of the other ends of stories that I asked her about. She didn't have a response, but she said Patty Howe would never commit suicide. She would have slipped off that, off those rocks, because the configuration of them is slightly different now than it was when she was growing up, walking around there. The marina has changed. It's one of those things in the stories that has changed. And also, she's now an adult, and that she once could scramble all over those rocks as a young person. She's no longer young, and she would have slipped. Elizabeth said she had too much to live for to commit suicide at that point.
Leslie.
Oh, I agree with that. In that case, I did think that was an accident. In regard to what Jackson was saying earlier, two points about the constant theme of suicide in this book. When you look through and you see the litany of woes, suicide, betrayal, depression, loneliness, adultery, in every story, I came to think that the stories that directly involved Olive really were the most powerful. The ones that brought in these themes, in which Olive is only glancingly a character, that at times they felt almost oppressive to me in a way that I came to think at the end, sort of with a nod to Forrest Gump and his view of life as a box of chocolates, that maybe in this book she was saying every life is like a donut. In the middle of each one is a big empty hole. You know, no matter how sweet it is, there was misery everywhere. And when I looked at the book as a whole and I considered, she's not showing us a cold, wintry, miserable Maine. She's showing us a Maine of tulips and sailboats and bayberry bushes. And she's showing us people who are well enough off to build additions on their home with cathedral ceilings and glass bay windows looking out over the ocean. There's people retiring early, people with enough money to build their children's second homes. So that it's not a world that is in itself a troubled world, so that all the grief seems to be presented as inherent to life itself. For each person, life itself is full of loneliness and despair. The potential is there. And even those who manage to slip away, like Olive's son, winds up, you know, divorced in California in a squalid brownstone that's dark and dirty in Brooklyn. So the grimness of the tales, after a while, started to take a toll on me.
Well, I think going back to the idea of the donut and the hole in the middle, she says, at least it's the first, I'm not sure it's the first time, but when I went back through the book, and Jackson and I talked earlier, you have to give this book two readings almost to catch everything. But you get the sense, she says, she's talking to this young anorexic, and she said, we're all starving. Don't you know we're all starving? Why do you think I eat so many donuts?
And here Olive is described as quite hefty.
And several times she talks about, she says, don't be afraid of your hunger to other people. Mm. Don't be afraid of your hunger, which I kept thinking, how do we interpret this with Olive? And I kept thinking, she's saying, this is part of it. Don't compromise with yourself. Don't be like Henry and just be nice to people, which is what Henry does with his hunger. He learned from his mother, who'd had several breakdowns and was clearly emotionally fragile, just to gauge everybody's temperature and to go through life helping others. He was a take-care person. She thinks she's not, but she is, and that's part of her tragedy, too.
Before we open the phones and welcome our fellow readers into the discussion, we've got to talk about A Different Road, the story in which Olive and Henry are driving home from dinner with friends when Olive says she must stop and use a restroom. And what happens is they finally stop at a hospital. And there is a hostage situation in which Olive utters some terrible things about her husband and his mother, for which Henry can never forgive Olive.
He also says a terrible thing about her.
Yes.
They both think die, and they both have clashed in ways.
They both think they're going to die.
Yeah.
And they both burst out with this thing that they've been, you know, sort of burying for their whole married life. And it just comes out. Go ahead, Jackson.
Well, there are several things about that story that I think are characteristic of the book as a whole. First of all, that story starts out very amusing. As you say, they stop at this hospital. All she wants to do is go to the bathroom. And before she knows it, they're examining her and finding things wrong with her and putting her on a table. And you begin to think this is going to be a very funny story. Well, of course, it doesn't turn out to be. The other thing that happens in that story is that Olive despite everything, and this is, of course, what we call the Stockholm syndrome, becomes attracted to the young boy who is holding her hostage. And again, that's one of those stories where if you know about Olive's relationship with Christopher and the fact that Christopher by this time has moved away and been a tremendous disappointment to her, you can begin to understand, aside from the Stockholm syndrome where hostages begin to identify or be attracted to their hostage holders, beyond that, you can see something of why, at the end of the story, we find out that Olive is knitting clothing for this young boy who's now in prison.
Well, of course, this young boy covered her up when she is sitting there half naked on the floor as a hostage with her hands behind her back and her hospital gown comes undone. And Henry points this out to everybody in the room, who immediately starts staring at Olive's corpulent nakedness. But so I think in a way she's repaying him. But again, I do think it's the teacher, the maternal force. And I just have to say that, Jackson, I'm so glad to hear you say that you thought it was amusing, because I was roaring out loud during that chapter. And I thought, oh, my God, there's something wrong with me that I'm finding this so funny. But it was truly hysterical.
I was just going to say, I wouldn't even call it the Stockholm syndrome. It's just too much of a pattern of Olive with every young man, every wounded bird, whether they're young girls, which she does with this young anorexic girl, or these young men.
Who are really after drugs.
Who are really after drugs. And this one, but she sees the wounded bird. She thinks at the end he's going to kill himself. And she says, oh, don't.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And it's time to open the phones, first to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Elaine. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I think I'm more excited to speak to you than I am to talk about Olive.
Well, we're happy to have you. Go right ahead.
Well, thanks for everything, Diane. My comment is probably global because your guests are just doing such a remarkable job. I read the book a while back, and I didn't know anything about it, but I remember that I squirmed through the whole book. And one of your guests used the word juxtaposition. And I thought, chapter one, an obnoxious person, and then how you get drawn in with her humanity and how I as a woman could identify with her. I think she's going to be one of these characters for all times. I would like to end with something that I heard, a comment about Beatles music and what made it great. And it was that it was unpredictable and ever-changing. Even if you just took a song, their songs were unpredictable and ever-changing and morphing in what they did. And I think that that's what this book is like.
Elaine, thanks so much for your call. What do you think about the analogy, the comparison between Olive Kitteridge, these stories, and Beatles music?
Well, I think that's one of the things that makes us all human, that you can't ever pin us down. I mean, we tend to use glib phrases about one another, and they're never sufficient. And I think what this book is an answer to all glib linguistic analyses of people.
All right. Thanks for your call, Elaine. Now to Durham, New Hampshire. Julian, you're on the air.
Hi. I was calling in regard to the concept of a series of connected short stories reading like a novel. I used to teach Hemingway's In Our Time, his first collection of stories as a novel, primarily about a character named Nick Adams. But whenever Hemingway wrote about a character who was not sympathetic to him or not the kind of person that young Ernest Hemingway wanted to be, he gave the character another name. But there's a progression from childhood through adult life, from Indian Camp with a birth to Big Two-Hearted River, one of the fishiest fishing stories ever written. But I would be interested if the author of Olive Kitteridge had read In Our Time.
Do you have any idea?
I can't believe that she hasn't. But because almost everybody has. But yeah, I think that's a pretty good analogy. I'd just like to say one thing about the last story in the book, which really does provide a coda. One of the things you have to notice about the last story is that Olive ends up at the end of that story with a man who is himself not a Maine person. He has come from outside of Maine. And he's a Republican besides. And, you know, here is this woman who has so much contempt for the outsiders and who certainly has contempt for Republicans. And the fact that she ends up with this man goes to show that we always make compromises and we always make do and we always find our comforts in places where we least suspect we can find them.
She was quite faithful, going to the nursing home each day where Henry had lost pretty much everything. He could barely see. He couldn't hear. He didn't do much besides sit there. And yet she went every single day.
And she called him. That was truly the most touching thing, is that when she goes to visit her son in New York, she calls Henry every day to give him a description of not even knowing whether he can hear her or understand a word she's saying.
Leslie. Which speaks to her loneliness.
Yes.
Indeed.
Emptiness.
We're talking about the book Olive Kittredge by Elizabeth Strout. When we come back, more of your calls. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is an integral part of every patient's treatment plan. More at cancercenter.com. From CarMax, offering more than 35,000 used cars and trucks, online and in stores from coast to coast. Learn more at CarMax.com. From the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
On the next Fresh Air, race relations north of the Mason-Dixon line. Historian Jason Sokol says while many in the Northeast looked with scorn at the racism of the Jim Crow South, there was racial violence, discrimination, and segregation in their own communities. Sokol is the author of All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. Join us.
Welcome back. We'll go right back to the phones, this time to Nancy in Atlantic Beach, Florida. Nancy, I gather you have read Olive Kittredge rather closely.
Oh, I have, Diane, and I'm thrilled to be talking with you, but I'm having a driveway moment because I have to tell you that you're all wrong about Olive.
Okay. How so?
Well, as I read the book, all I could imagine was that her ultimate purpose in life was control. With all of the people that she felt sympathy or empathy or wanted to help, she was, in a sense, in control of all of these issues. And as a teacher...
And no especially how, a math teacher.
I can't understand that.
I said, especially as a math teacher.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my next point. As a teacher, you are in control, in a hopefully a very lovely way, but you are in control. And all the way through the book, Christopher, she couldn't control, but he didn't fight back. He just took off.
Yeah, but I think it's more complicated than that. as relationships always are. There was a wonderful moment on an interview program with Elizabeth Strout that I heard where an anorexic girl called in. This woman said she'd been an anorexic for 20 years. And that moment in that story when Olive talks to the anorexic girl, said this anorexic girl on this call-in, Olive said the one thing to her that she wished somebody had said to her. Now, you know, you can talk about control. You can talk about, you're absolutely right. I'm a teacher. We love to control. But she meant a great deal to that anorexic girl at that moment. And so regardless of what the motive is, it works.
And she even talks about control.
She talks about control herself. Mm-hmm. I think you've made good points, Nancy. I think that everybody sort of sees this book through their own perspective. And,
absolutely.
And you've seen it in that way. I thank you for calling this morning. I want to get to one of what I consider the most dramatic moments in this book. She is in Brooklyn. She has been asked to come to Brooklyn to stay with her son and his second wife. She tells Christopher before she goes, he asks her to come and stay for a week because he needs her there to care for children. She says, before she even goes, after 3 days, I stink like a fish. And then, again, she gets insulted by something that Christopher and his wife say.
Well, actually, it's the ice cream.
No, it's not ice cream. It's
the butterscotch sauce.
Butterscotch.
They go out for a sundae, and butterscotch sauce dribbles down the front of her blouse. She takes it off and thinks she's going to wash it. And all of a sudden, it comes back to her about an old, kind of dithering aunt of hers. And she realizes that they don't respect her enough to tell her that she's dribbled down the front of her blouse. And the humiliation of realizing that they didn't accord her that care and respect to tell her that she should clean it off so infuriates her that this moment of reunion with her son is completely destroyed for her, and she decides to leave summarily.
And so, Mom, stop it, Christopher says. And she says, it's time for me to go home. I stink like fish. Christopher shook his head slowly. I knew this was going to happen. I knew something would trigger things off. What are you talking about? Olive said. I'm simply telling you it's time for me to go home. Then come inside, Christopher said. I guess I don't need my son telling me what to do, Olive said. But when Chris went back inside, murmuring to Anne, his wife, she did get up. She joined them in the kitchen. She sat in a chair by the table. She had hardly slept and felt shaky. Did something happen, Mom? Anne said. You weren't going to leave for a few more days. She'd be damned if she was going to tell them how they let her sit there and dribble stuff down herself. They'd have treated their own kids better than that, wiped the mess off, but her they just let sit there. And Christopher says, I asked you to come visit because I wanted to see you and wanted to meet you. We were hoping we could just have a nice time. I was hoping things had changed, that this wouldn't happen. But, Mom, I'm not going to take responsibility for the extreme capriciousness of your moods. If something happened to upset me, you should tell me. That way we can talk. You've never talked your whole damn life. Why are you starting now? It was the therapist, she realized suddenly. Of course, that foolish Arthur fellow. They had been seeing a therapist. Mm-hmm. And he Christopher had been talking about his mother and how she resented it.
But you also see there from what she's been like to Christopher, because he goes ahead and says, you're paranoid. You're this way one minute.
You hit me.
Yeah, you hit me. And, you know, social workers would now come to the house. But, and then he goes on at the, because I love the part, you say you want to leave, then accuse me of kicking you out, which is part of that same scene. In the past, it would make me feel terrible, but I'm not going to feel terrible now. I mean, because that's what she has done. And the fact that it dripped down, remember, this is a household which everything drips down.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mess.
Very, it's a mess. It's a loose household. Yeah.
It just depends on your point of view.
Yeah. I mean,
the
yeah.
way she sees herself and the way he sees her are completely different.
But instead of arguing with her, he takes on this very calm, rational tone. He doesn't fight. He just said, fine, I'll call the car for you. And the car will come and take you to the airport. She is devastated.
Yeah, and after the extreme hopefulness, the truly most hopeful and beautiful part of the book for me is when she is anticipating that visit with the son. And suddenly, even in the plane, which she's never been in a plane by herself before, just the beauty of the world and this moment of possibility stretches before her, the kind of new optimism, and to see it dash at the end is just
totally
tragic.
All right, let's go to Mary, who's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mary, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane.
Sure.
My comment is I enjoy this author. I have read her other novels and enjoyed them more than Olive Kitteridge. I don't like Olive. I read the book, and maybe I a second read would help me. I gave the book to a friend and said, you know, I'm recommending this book, but I really don't like the main character. But my comment is, I think Ursula Hagee does a better job at this idea of combining short stories and novels. The book I really enjoy is Floating in My Mother's Palm, and you can take any one of those chapters and just pick it up, separate from the other ones, and get a really in-depth look at characters. And I think that, I'm not sure if your guests have read that book, but I really think that Ursula Hagee does a much better job at combining these short stories.
All right, Kate?
I think this is truly just magnificent. And full disclosure, Elizabeth Strout did give me a wonderful blurb for my last book. So that said, I can't, you know, I should say that, I guess. But the fact is that this book, I think, has much more power. I don't want to get into comparisons. That's not fair. But I feel that I know every character in a story when she does a story. Any of the main characters that are highlighted, I feel I've gone very deep with them.
All right. Mary, thanks for your call. And now to Allison in Bellport, New York. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to say that to me, one of the most interesting aspects of this book is the way Olive is able to be both physically abusive to her child and also to love him very much. And I think, you know, people are very, very strange. I think Elizabeth Strout shows that very brilliantly.
I think you're right, Allison. And I think that one of the fascinating aspects about this is that Olive somehow doesn't realize until toward the very end why her son is so angry with her. And he is angry.
You know, there's a great scene when Olive calls Henry to tell him about her visit in New York. And she says, she's recounting what's going on in Brooklyn to him. And not even, of course, he can't answer because he's had this massive stroke. And she says to him, today's their wedding anniversary. They're okay, but she's dumb, just like I thought. They're in therapy. She hesitated, looking around. You're not to worry about that, Henry. In therapy, they go straight after the mother. You come out smelling like a rose, I'm sure.
which is certainly the case most times.
Because she doesn't see it in her problems. No. They go straight after the mother.
Well, exactly.
Now, like most people, she can see everything around her much more clearly than she can see herself.
Exactly.
Of course, and her temper and her anger, she does at one point say, I know it comes up in me, that squid juice,
right.
That I think she calls, you know, the black ink comes out, that she can't. But she just kind of excuses it. It's just part of her. You take it because, again, you don't compromise. You don't let your hunger, don't be afraid of your hunger. You just do what you, say what you want to.
Let's now go to Avalon, New Jersey. You're on the air, Mickey.
Yes, Diane, I'm so honored to be on your show.
Oh, so glad to have you. Thank you.
Thank you. Olive Kitteridge is the selection of my book club, and the book club is called the Literacy Book Club, and literacy with the last three letters are S-E-A, because we're so close to the Atlantic Ocean. And our meeting is on July 21st, so this is absolutely fabulous. I just want to make a comment to dispute Kate, and I know that's not what you do, but I started reading this book, and I was distressed and down and upset, and I thought it was so depressing. And I realized as I got into the stories that my distress was now coming from the fact that I didn't want the stories to end. And every time I turned the page and saw a new title, I was so saddened because I wanted to go further with the characters. I could read every one of these 13 stories in a 300-page novel. I think she's marvelous, and I thank your guests because I do need to go back and read the entire book again.
Good, Mickey, and I'm sure you'll have a very rich discussion at your book club.
And we're going to have a great time. Thank you so much, all of you.
Go ahead, Kate.
This is Kate, and I didn't say that. I think they're just wonderful and, again, uplifting by the end, but I didn't see any of them as oppressive.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. One caller that we lost, Sally from Detroit, indicated that she felt Olive was depressed all the way through the book. What do you think?
Well, I just wanted to read, everybody's reading things, and this is a book that cries out to be read aloud.
Yep.
I love the moment when she's visiting this woman whose husband has just died and told her that her husband, that her cousin has revealed to her on the day of the husband's funeral that she, the cousin, had an affair with the husband. And she says, for a while, neither woman speaks. This is Olive talking to the widow.
The widow.
Then Marlene says pleasantly, I've been thinking about killing Carrie. She raises a hand from her lap and exposes a small paring knife lying on her green flowered dress. Oh, says Olive. Marlene bends over the sleeping Carrie and touches the woman's bare neck. Isn't this some major vein, she asks, and puts the knife flat against Carrie's neck, even poking slightly. Yeah, okay, might want to be a little careful there, Olive sits forward. In a moment, Marlene sighs, sits back, okay, here, and she hands the paring knife to Olive. Now, of all the responses Olive could have had at that moment, might want to be a little careful there, is such a perfect moment. I mean, you know, instead of getting up and screaming and saying, let me call the police,
she tries
to handle the situation, and she knows in some way exactly what to do.
But why, other than cruelty, which is part of Olive's character, why, other than cruelty, would she reveal to the widow that this had gone on?
Well, it's Carrie who reveals. It's the drunken cousin who reveals to the widow that this happened. So that's why
I had that wrong.
Yeah,
there.
That's why.
Okay.
Yeah, and so Olive's just sitting there with her, which
the
is an unusual thing
Carrie.
For Olive to do anyway.
God.
But the drunken Carrie has said, yes, I had. But once she says, which is not, of course, what the widow believes anyway, and Olive knows how, probably how she would respond and what should be done. I'm sure Olive thought about knives many times in her life.
You know, actually, there are three stories in which people sort of find out very belatedly that their spouse has been cheating on them, or that there has been a betrayal behind their back, including one that Angela, the piano player, finds out that her mother tried to seduce her boyfriend. The seemingly most happy couple, those Holtons, who she finds out her husband has been going to see a mistress in Florida. And so I think this theme keeps coming up of people having these little secret romances.
And I don't mean to in any way detract from the magnificence of this novel, but there is a sense of Peyton Place here. I mean, with all these interwoven characters, stories, affairs, unpleasantness, really absolutely extraordinary. Thank you all so much for joining us this month for our Reader's Review. Kate Lehrer, Leslie Maitland, Jackson Breyer. The book is Olive Kitteridge by Elizabeth Stroud. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Urblifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.